And because we're going to press for time, I thought that what I would not do is that, but I would do the permitting assignment, unless there's demand that you all really want to see the application. But I was going to do the application as an assignment, because it has all the steps, it has the permitting you asked for. So the last thing I do for the Gulfs and Bosons would be talk about a couple of issues that come up if you're doing it or not in the relevant systems, which won't take very long because the things aren't enormous, but there's interesting things that happen. So the Gulfs and bosons are everywhere in relativistic physics. You know, like the ones we'll talk about are spin waves, the various systems where you have spin ordering, there's the sound waves, there's a sense which there are Gulfs and bosons. There's such two. There's more. It's just not hitting right now. But, you know, a lot of symmetries there are broken and there's dramatic. But the, of course, the system there, the ultraviolet depletion there at some level is closer to many levels, but eventually you're going to get the, you know, the lattice of atoms, if it's solid or if it's a fluid. Or, and so it needn't, this many symmetries that we're assuming, won't, the space-time symmetries won't be symmetries of those systems. And so what the natural one you often think about is rotational invariance. And whether that's a symmetry or not depends, you know, on the system. So it could be that you're interested in a lattice which has some lattice symmetry, which is some subgroup of rotations. But in practice, when we're looking at the fewest number of derivatives, as you'll see, it's often true that what you should be doing in non-relativistic applications is you'll be looking at you want to write in the long distance limit a continuum vector field theory, which is describing scales that are very long compared to these microscopic scales. In principle, they're going to be invariant under, strictly speaking, they'll be invariant under the discrete lattice group. But it's often true that the fewest derivatives in the problem, if they're invariant under, say, cubic rotations where you're rotating 90 degrees everywhere, that's sufficient to make them invariant under all rotations at two derivative level. If you kind of go to higher and higher derivatives, then there are some things you can have which are not rotation invariant, which are lattice rotation invariant. But for the fewest derivatives, if we're talking about two derivatives, it's often true for cubic symmetries, for instance, that the lattice symmetry is sufficient to guarantee that by accident two derivative things are rotation invariant. Or it could also be whether you're talking about a fluid or something which doesn't have a lattice and it is rotation invariant. But both those examples have a preferred frame. So independent of rotation invariance, there's the whole space time Lorentz invariants that are being broken. So what was that? How does that change what we're doing? And the main thing it does, I'm going to focus on two derivative interactions. So for the less than or equal to two derivative. So systems like fluids. Need to be rotation invariant. Sometimes they are. That could be because it's a fluid and it really is rotation invariant, or it could be because it's a cubic lattice and it's by accident rotation invariant at two derivative level. So whatever doesn't really make any difference for us, at the end of the day, those two derivatives are less than two derivatives. By accident there means not just because I forgot to write it down, but accident because lattice symmetry. The lattice symmetry is sufficient to imply rotation, right? That's the rest frame of fluid, or the rest frame of the solid, or whatever. If you're moving through fluid, you know it, because you get fluid in the face. If you're stationary in fluid. So that means they break the run stretch. It can be true that they accidentally preserve translations. You know, they might only have discrete lattice translations, but on long scales, that's going to flow down to being effectively translation invariant. So it's not unusual to have a translation invariant, rotation invariant, for instance, with a low derivative level system that's not Lorentz invariant. It's worth thinking about what that would change there. Maybe or maybe not. So I'll use momentum conservation. So keep that. So now there's an issue of thinking of the Poincaré group. What's left? You know, we've got rotations. We don't have Lorentz transformations. We do have translations, and then there's things like time reversal and parity. And those will be important. We can also have me working on TOP. And an important example which breaks time reversal invariants would be Fermat, where you've got all sorts of spins lined up, and the spins from time reversal would have reversed. And so the spins are, in that case, breaking time reversal invariants. And that's different from, say, an anti-Fermat, where every lattice site has a spin, and every second site they're altering. That's their ordering, but they're ordering in a way which there's not a macroscopic spin, but there still is an order parameter. And the order parameter in that case would just be sum of all the spins weighted by an alternating sign, so that they would add up. But under time reversal, that's actually invariant because the spins all flip. That's another thing to add. So. The anti-paramagnet. So this is where spins are all aligning. And this is all for all. Yeah. And that's an important distinction because, you know, as particle physicists, we always tend to talk about paramagnets as being the concrete garden variety example of Boltzmann bosons and symmetry breaking. And if you're trying to explain, you know, how Higgs mechanism works to somebody in the street, often a Fermat is there, maybe someone in a physics department. Fermat is what comes up. And that's actually not the best example because the anti-Fermat is actually better because the Fermat is the dispersion relation, for instance, for the magnons, the Boltzmann bosons in the anti-Fermat are very similar to the ones that you would have had for a relativistic system. It's just the speed of light is being replaced by the speed of sound. For anti-paramagnet, the dispersion relations are very different. The frequency goes like the momentum squared rather than the momentum. And that's because of this time reversal invariance. And so the issue there will be that when we look at the Lagrangian, there's term moving right down. The reason I'm saying less than or equal to 2 rather than just 2 is that if you break time reversal invariance, you're allowed to break down things that are linear in time. And so that's my love for the language. Then the most general cluster equal to two derivative self interactions. So the first thing that we try is no derivatives, and that would be potential energy, and we never get potential energy for Boltzmann bosons because they have a shift part of the symmetry. And so in the shift part of the symmetry, you can't have potential energy, which is a function of, you know, the only invariant translation invariant function of x is constant. So we could have a constant, I guess, and minus b naught. So that's the cosmological constant problem for an entire system. It's not really a problem, it's just energy. Energy to do with fluid. Then you have one derivative. You can't have one space derivative. Well, let's assume rotation, translation, and invariance. You can't have one spatial derivative because rotational invariance is going to require two of them to contract the. Part of being a fluid is talking about, but I won't explain what system. So something, so we could have something like G, A, B, grad. And on dimensional grounds, you know, I haven't been thinking too much about dimensions here. But if we're thinking of these things as being angles, which is more or less how they came to us, then they're dimensionless, and these derivatives for each mass, this is supposed to be mass to the fourth for energy density in three dimensions. So if this is a metric and we think of it as being dimensionless, as a function of these angles, then we need a scale here, which we could call f squared, which is some mass scale squared. It normalizes the whole thing. And I'm assuming that the symmetry G over H, if there's more than one metric here, we've taken only a combination of them. So if there's at least one parameter in this Lagrangian, which is this number F, there may be more depending on how many invariant metrics we have for this pattern. But let's take a simple case where there's only one. And now for time derivatives, rotational invariance will allow us to have one time derivative, but time reversal won't. So that's the difference between the hermetic and anti-hermetic. So for having time derivatives, we have to have two. So again, we would have, we call this space, F sub space, so we have two times squared. So in principle, if you calculate, if you want to know how things behave in the lower limit, it's going to be dominated by these terms. In the same way that if we'd been relativistically looking at things, we would have, these two things would have been, the Lorentz transformation would have related Ft and Fs together to give us 1 half F squared Pab alpha U theta alpha U theta alpha if the Lorentz. So the fact that we've got the ratio of these things is a new parameter that wasn't there before. The overall scale, F, was there before. The ratio was a new scale. That's the thing, the dimensional scale, that's the thing that's going to be playing the role of propagation speed. If we take these equations of motion and we linearize them and ask, kind of, what are the long wavelength modes, then so for disturbances. equation motion we're going to get from that is so it would be something like theta alpha dot dot plus gamma alpha theta. We're getting these other Christoffel symbols for that target space network. Assuming that the space time is flat, that's the only, you know, we're not, there's no camera to be. So, you know, it's not surprisingly, it's kind of interesting that the, if you had no space time at all, this is a geodesic equation. And so what you're finding is that if you have time-dependent field configurations, then there's a geometrical interpretation to this target space metric, and the trajectories you want to follow are our geodesics in the target space. And so if your target space had been a sphere, say it was SF3 divided by SF2, then these things would be describing, you know, great circle motion around the equator of the sphere, depending on where it works. Alright, so you've got some equations, and so in particular, if theta doesn't go very far, so if we're allowed to Taylor expand the power of theta, this is, you know, then I get to Taylor expand everything around theta naught. So I have a linear S again. What will happen is that the only things that are, so this is going to kill me because the time derivatives are all fluctuations. So I guess you don't have to see that anyway, so you don't care. Then we're going to get the theta alpha. And that thing, you know, has wave solutions where the dispersion relation can be frequency squared is the speed of sound squared times p squared. And the speed of sound in this case is going to be fs squared.
Plus,
yeah.
Where did you get that equation?
How did I get this wrong?
No, you just looked at the equation's motion.
I've done this before. Which one are you talking about, going from this line to this line? Or this line from that line?
Yeah, that one, yeah.
So it's just that, you know, so you have to vary theta. So you vary this one and you integrate by parts. That picks up derivative here and derivative here. Vary this one and you integrate by parts. You vary this one because the theta is the g's. So with the two integration by parts, the derivative is getting this. And the one where you vary the theta directly in here and the ones that are giving the Christoffel symbols. And the one, when you integrate parts, the derivative is getting twice here, and that's supposed to be the del squared and the time derivative.
Is there a way to see this? Sort of my opinion.
Yeah,
if I'd taken the square root of this, then it would have been.
Yeah, we don't have any exactly reaction to it.
Yeah.
Is the thing?
Just for a particle.
The part probably should have a weak square root of the cube, but the square root is not making a difference to the base motion, it's the overall factor which I can apply. You have a freedom in how you write the action for the particle. You can where are they making the polygon way or the go way? This is probably the polygon way, right?
And then can you pick a parameter that we get rid of that part of that represent?
Which one?
For the GODs. Although they're not dots.
These are dots and these are parameters.
Yeah, sorry.
But here, this statement here was specialized in spatial independence. So I just take part of the time and I
I'm sorry. The only reason why it looks funny is because it's the dots are tundra. The gammas are Christoffel symbols on the target space.
Yeah.
So is it not deceiving to call that a GODs equation because those are not derivatives with respect to other thetas, right?
No, but if I had been in short circle and I wanted a GODs equation, what would you have written down? You would have written down the
dot is technically with respect to proper time, right?
X dot dot mu, and so on. Mu dot lambda, things in X dot lambda, zero, okay?
If you're in an affine parameter.
Yeah, with an affine parameter. And so, and the affine parameters, that's probably what's going on. If I had, for this to be applied, I should have really had a, if this is by the same thing as the world line, I should have had the line of the world line, make it. And then if I hit gauge fix that, the fact that I didn't write that means I chose a gauge test one that's making a path on the parameter. So if I kept that, then I can work that then the thing on the right hand side. And it's probably if I integrate that out, then I could make that actually into the line. In the same way you would with the all right, so bottom line there was this is the thing that looks a lot and walks a lot and smells a lot like a Goldstone goes on the way a relativistic person would think about it. Because its frequency is basically the energy squared is proportional to the momentum squared. And what would have been the speed of light here is being replaced by this ratio. And if we had been relativistic, these things would have been equal. And so this would have been 1, which is the energy using the speed of light. So that's one of the little things. The thing that I told you I was, if someone would complain about it, I mentioned this, is I said you only have one space derivative here, and the example I was using was spins. And then strictly speaking, for rotations, I could have had the order parameter dotted with, if theta was itself a vector, I could have it dotting with a gradient, with a gradient. So I can imagine like theta dot grad, theta, two theta dot grad. So I'm explicitly assuming here that I'm not, my symmetry is acting internally on the thetas, and it's not acting on space-time and the thetas together. So how's it made for any ferromagnets? For any ferromagnets, at first sight, it sounds like nothing changed, because for an anti-ferromagnet,
do you need ferromagnet?
Right. E is broken, and so the term here in DT is allowed. But it's tempting to think that it's just always a total derivative. So it's like thinking that you're right. The one derivative term would be, we call it minus. The theta, linear and theta dot, is the constant coefficient which I'll call, A alpha theta. I guess that in itself doesn't look so bad. This is some vector field living on the target space. So in the picture that had space time and it had target space x and theta mapping from space time to x, this A alpha is some vector that lives everywhere here. It's a vector field. But we're asking for this thing to be invariant under the motion g, which is basically moves you. You can get from any point k here, any other point here by doing a G-transformation, because these closer bosons were defined by basically doing these G-transformations. So that doesn't look like we're looking for an invariant vector field, which looks like we're going to have a hard time finding one, because you know, if you have a vector field, let's choosing a position, it's not going to likely be one for which you're allowed to. There's no, for instance, in a sphere, there would be a direct vector field in the sphere. And the sphere is the one that's of most interest. We're thinking of this thing being a non-Scott ferromagnet, where the rotation group that we broke was the rotations of spins in space, which is SO2 or SO3. And the unbroken group is the one that's rotating around the preferred direction of the ferromagnet ground state phase. And so that really is a two-sphere. So we're looking for, principle, if we're looking for this to be invariant under G, we have to ask, in the same way we ask for the two derivative terms for the metric to be in a metric which is invariant for not for the ground metric, we for the two sphere rather, we have to put it written down. In this case, it looks like it's going to be not allowed to write an A down, because we know that there are no rotation invariant vectors on the sphere. And so, what's up with that? And the interesting thing that's up with that is that in the actual case of interest for two squares, this thing is actually can be there, and for fair amount it is there. Because it's got fewer time derivatives than the other terms, it dominates. So if this thing is present, this will give a, this will change the dispersion relation for linearized sound waves. Instead of being frequency squared is equal to some number times b squared, it becomes something linear in frequency is some number times b squared. And that's the right dispersion relation for magnons paramagnet. So it's kind of puzzling that this term seems like it should be there, but it, on the other hand, geometrically it seems like it should be there, because how are we going to get a direct vector field on the two sphere in the case of interest for paramagnet, like we're breaking SO3 and SO2. And the answer is interesting, because the statement isn't that the action, see, the statement that A is invariant would be the statement that the Lagrangian is invariant. We don't have to actually require that. It's sufficient to demand that the action is invariant. So we could have asked for the Lagrangian to go into a total derivative. That would be sufficient to have the case entry. So in some cases, for example, SO3. Even if there isn't, it doesn't make a difference, because conditions for invariance is not that B is invariant or A is invariant. But G being a symmetry, only requires the action, which is the interval T dx. So in this case, we should really be asking, when is the variation of L one derivative equal to a full derivative? So it's, since this only involves time derivatives, all doesn't really matter of time derivatives, so we want to know when is it equal to d dt some omega of theta. Well, so if you do a variation, so if you take theta alpha goes to theta alpha plus delta theta alpha, like I did for the metric, you just repeat that exercise here and ask what does happen to A alpha theta theta dot alpha. Well, if I vary this guy, I get A alpha times delta theta alpha dot. If I vary that theta, I'm going to get partial theta A alpha. And in the same way that So if I do the thing that if I integrate my parts, if I write this as being a total derivative, so ddt a alpha minus alpha, which is another way of saying that is that's d beta a alpha. Again, in the same way that the thing we got for the variation of the, so what's happened is that if I ignore this piece, the thing A alpha, theta alpha dot, change into A total alpha, A total alpha dot, and A total alpha, A alpha plus this stuff. And this stuff is again the lead derivative. So it's geometrically the same kind of thing. It's transforming. This A is transforming like a vector field on target space. And that's something which you needed to know to digest what I said over here about there not being any vector fields that are appearing. I had to tell you how the vector field was transforming, and implicitly what I said was that it was transforming like a vector field. Let's do this transformation. Let's do this change of data. Now, for the, if we specialize with symmetry, what we'd like to have. The condition that the action be invariant is not that this vanished. So there's no vectors in the sphere whose lead derivative vanished to be invariant. But it's sufficient for this thing to be this thing. So if I ask what that looks like, what's the condition for the symmetry change of variables to be a total derivative? We'll see that it's got an interesting meaning for A. If delta L1 derivative is equal to, which is equal to that thing I just wrote down, so let me call it derivative. I'm grouping the wrong thing here. This should have been delta. Because the lead derivative should have been the thing that was in the direction of the. I did a small change in the coordinate, so my vector field is this thing. And the lead derivative should involve the vector field in A. So theta dot is going along the right. So over here, this is some thing. I don't know what it is. So if I do the derivative, this thing, whatever it is omega dot. It's d alpha omega. Theta times theta dot alpha. I don't know if it's clear what I'm saying anymore. The statement I had been demanding before that the Lagrangian be invariant. What I'm now asking is that the variation of this particular term would be a total derivative because that's sufficient for the action to be invariant. So since the variation of Lagrangian was of the total derivative, the lead derivative of A times theta dot, the condition that this is equal to the total derivative is that the lead derivative of A is equal to the gradient of omega. So the change in A, which is what the lead derivative of A was, we're asking that to be the gradient of something. And that's something which you recognize, right? That's, we're not asking for a vector field on the target space, we're asking for a gauge field. The action of the symmetry on the coordinates theta is turning into a gauge transformation for the gauge potential A, which is very important. And that's useful because that says that if you want something, if you want geometrically to find something which is on a say a two sphere, which is invariant under rotations of the two sphere, we don't have to find an invariant gauge potential. You only have to find a gauge potential which is invariant up to a gauge transformation. That is to say, we're trying to find an invariant field strength. So invariance, S invariance only requires K alpha to be invariant up to the gauge transformation. And that's another way of saying that is that we're going to ask for F alpha beta, A alpha A beta, and B beta A alpha, D invariant. And that we can find on a two-sphere. Right? If you, the field configuration on a two-sphere, which is invariant under rotations of a two-sphere, is a monopole, magnetic monopole of a two-sphere. Because if the magnetic field is pointing out everywhere, and that's something which, the magnetic field pointing out the monopole is like saying that F theta phi is non-zero on the surface of the monopole. So that's an F community that's living in the monopole, the surface of the sphere. And that's something which is perfectly rotation invariant. Because it's just proportional to the volume form. So this does exist, for sure. And it has the property that you can only write this A down locally on the sphere. And so it doesn't contradict the fact that you can't find an invariant vector everywhere in the sphere, but you can find one which is different just by gauge transformation, and that gauge transformation is what relates the A on either side of the sphere, if you can divide it through the sphere overlap. Right? So, in the example of most interest for paramagnet, which is SO3, SO2, SO3, SO2, two sphere. And this is basically the beta is equal to F theta phi is equal to sine theta, if I remember right. So that means that A phi is equal to cosine theta. That's the thing we're looking for. So the thing we'd be looking for, if we're using theta phi as coordinates on the two-sphere, our one derivative action would have been some number, let's call it C, times cosine theta, theta drop. But only locally. It looks like it's still derivative, but you can't do this everywhere in the sphere. There's only some place where you couldn't define theta. Couldn't define A this way. I probably have to ask this thing to plus or minus. That's just the observation that I want to leave you with for this, is that you can get these dispersion relations that look counterintuitive for paramagnets, and they are possible because the thing geometrically you're looking for has an interpretation being a gauge field in the target space, and it is possible to find examples of that in particular for the case of most interest is the SO2, magnetic monopole configuration is exactly what you're looking for. It's not zero everywhere, Fenium is not zero everywhere. So even though it looks like you can't write them down, you can. And that's what accounts for this dispersion relation being linear frequency. Any questions on that? But the important thing in this whole story is that these things, the functional form of this A and the functional form of the metric are being determined after normalizations. And so, for example, you get the ratio of those FS and FT on the speed of waves. But if you look at the scattering of magnons from each other, then you have a statement about how they are scattering because the functional form of that whole Lagrangian that you wrote about was for instance, is just like fine. So the principle is that soft ion scattering and soft magnon scattering theorems you could derive. So that's where I would leave Wilson bosons unless there's a So then the next thing I would do is, the next topic that we talked about doing was is the standard model is effective theory and then general relativity is effective theory. And for the standard model is effective theory, what I'd like to do is talk about the organizing. That's an example where if the standard model, if we know that the scales exist, the standard model has one scale in it. So let me write this out. Kind of a cartoon of where I want to go with this is, not too much detail, but the standard model looks and smells like an effective theory for something at higher energies that we don't understand yet. Largely because the kind of thing you get, as you've seen, as an effective field theory, when you take some known physics and you integrate out heavier physics and ask what you get at lower energies, you typically get everything. Everything's a lot about symmetries, possibly with some selection rules built in, so some terms are bigger than you thought or smaller than you thought. They're generically all there. And so if someone gives you a theory that's very successful in particle physics and says, what we have here is a theory which is the most general possible interactions that are normalizable, then that's exactly what you would have expected to get if someone had a theory of much higher energies, which they then integrated out to much higher energies we don't have access to currently, and looked at what was going on at low energies and neglected inverse powers of that scale that we don't know. We kept only the logarithms of that scale, things that are not suppressed at that scale. That's what would have told us to look at for normalizable piece. And then the standard model actually has that property that if you take all the particles that have been seen plus the Higgs boson that hasn't been seen, and you say, what's the most general thing you can write down that's normalizable, that is the standard model. That's the definition. So it looks like it's a low energy theory for something. And not only that, we have some idea that there is something else beyond the standard model that has to be described by this theory, whatever it is, because we know that dark matter exists, we know that gravity exists and is not part of that normalizing story. We know that, and gravity in particular points to a scale that we know is there. Gravity points to the Planck scale, which is much bigger than the scale of gravity, which is the scale that the standard model has. And so everything looks like there's stuff going on at very high energy. And it got better in the 90s when the neutrino masses were discovered, because that could also be pointing to a scale with an higher energy. It might not be. It might be pointing to very light new neutrinos that we haven't seen before. But one thing it could be pointing to is physics at a high scale and breaks up on them. So what I want to do is say that, well, so let's take the point of view of the standard model with spectral theory. Let's just look at what it's dimension by dimension, what you'd expect to find. And that kind of groups the way you think about the deviations from whatever you're going to replace that model with. Given that it is something heavier than the particles we've seen, then it gives you a way to think about what to expect. And you'll see that there's two kinds of things to expect. There's a huge success of the standard model already captures what we see, but then there's the question of two of the terms are bigger than or smaller than we would have thought to be. The physics that we're ignoring involves physics at very high scales. But then if we go past that to the non-normalizable terms that would start to capture the physics of high scales, when you follow inverse powers of that physics, you'll see that there's only one term possible at dimension 5 level, which is the first suppressed by only one power of mass. And if that were there, the only thing it would do was give us a neutrino mass. So it's been a very successful neutrino mass that we've seen. And then after that, there's a whole bunch of things that can happen at two powers of the inverse mass. And that includes many things that are almost certainly there, because the standard model is different to you. There's also things that break the symmetries that the standard model preserves, but not in an arbitrary way. So, point one is, in general, normalizable theory with the stone. Terrible content. Contains some truths. So, but it doesn't. Describe some things. Among those things are dark matter, energy, possibly, gravity, and that comes associated with a known scale in Planck. So we know there's something else, and so the fact that it's the most general thing, the one other scale we know about, which is not in Standard Model, is much bigger than the Standard Model. This is like 10 to the 18 GV, and that's much bigger than the 10 to the 2 GV, which is the typical Standard Model scale. So everything just smells like this is the large limit of something. So, what's wrong with that? Because we know that it's not everything. There's some things that are not being described properly, and so we want to pick at those things that we don't describe properly so we can see if we can figure out what's good. So, the field content, I'm not going to get too. So there's a bunch of gauge fields right there. There's SQ3, SQ2, U1 gauge invariants. So that's all this G alpha mu, W A mu, D mu. So this is describing the photon W plus C minus Z. Then there's the fermions. So this plus psi. And there's the what's the electron? Electron pino, up quark, down quark, and then three other generations. And it's going left and right hand pieces except the pino. And these guys are all colored. Then we have the one scalar. Doublet. Phi, which I'll call a phi plus. And three of these guys get eaten by the W and the V. Becomes the Z goes on. The W goes on. A longitudinal mode. And there's one physical thing. Three would be from bosons, which are eaten by these guys. And then there's one physical. And if you organize things by dimension, which is one of the classic ones, so what we should be thinking is that what we expect is spectrum theory, whatever it is going to be, include gravity. I'll throw G there just to remind you that it's there. But we would have something which is, potentially we could have something with, there would be at least a bunch of terms involving all the fields, size, location, field, some coefficients that are dimensionless, and their derivatives could also be here. And then some scale that appears, which depends on the dimension of the thing. And so if you kind of make the list, the first thing that we should be getting is some thing with no fields at all. Nothing, no symmetry forbids that. And because it's got, I'm thinking of the unit operator here, this whole Lagrangian has to have dimension of mass of the fourth, as usual. So this thing would have a coefficient m to the fourth, which is not suppressed by this big mass. In fact, this m should be big mass. But it's not the biggest mass out there. It's whenever we have a negative power of m, We should expect that the smallest mass we haven't seen yet to be the one that we're going to see that's allowed to contribute. And if we see something in the numerator, it should be the biggest mass that can contribute there, because we're typically going to get a sum over all possible masses that could be contributing. So in the numerator, the biggest one wins, and the denominator, the smallest one wins. So I'll call this the M big. We could have also had something. Now, there's nothing with dimension one power of mass, because all these fields have at least one power of mass as dimension. So if I have only one field, all I could write down would be something linear in the one of the bosonic fields, but that wouldn't be an invariant amplification group. So I can't do that, but I can do something at level 2, like m s squared. Well, that's c2 times m squared by dagger pi. That's what I need right now. Then there's a whole bunch of possibly log n coefficients, things which are dimension 4. And this is the business end of the standard model. The standard model normally is everything here plus this one term. So the only scale in the standard model is this one term. This is the thing that you would normally call mu, or would have been lambda b. Lambda is the quarter coupling in here. So this is the one thing that we know that b is 246 dB, because that shows up in the Fermi constant. And lambda is something which, if you believe Fermi wave theory, can't be too large. So if lambda is kind of, we're thinking it should be less than order of 4 pi, so this scale here, m, is not, we're not thinking it should be huge compared to hundreds of GeV scale. And at the dimension 2 level, if we include the graviton, there's something else we could have also written, I guess. We could have written plus pi squared r. So one of the weird things is that of these two things, this one came in with a huge mass. This one came in with a much smaller mass. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Unless there's some reason why some physics can't contribute to this but can contribute to this. So for example, if we're going to later on see that we saw already when we looked at the neutrinos of photons, that if there's a selection rule that forbids something contributing, you may get a mass occurring as a coefficient, which is not a naive one. So if there was some reason why the biggest masses in the problem were forbidden from contributing this symmetry thing, then you might expect them to drop out and not appear as a coefficient, and then since this will be the sum over all the things that contribute, it'll be the biggest one that can contribute that will dominate, and that may be lower because the symmetry which forbids the really big ones. So that's one way in which you might deviate from the change the standard model is to imagine putting you're going to put masses that are large. They have to be coming in a way, this line of thought, that protects their contributions from giving large contributions to that. And that's the line of argument that's going to be towards symmetry. The problem is that if you don't have a space-time symmetry, there's no internal symmetry for a classical for scalar field that can forbid this kind of a term, because the kinetic energy for a scalar field, normally the symmetries you're allowed to look for are the ones that are symmetries of kinetic energy. And that already is just phi goes to some unitary transformation times phi. So anything that's making this invariant is going to automatically make that invariant. If we had a bunch of real fields and wrote this as phi, dv, phi, transpose, dv, phi, then the combination of phi, transpose, phi is a column vector you would never fit. So these kind of scalar masses are generically a problem because the only symmetries that get rid of them are space-time symmetries. So naively, that would be scalar invariants to get rid of it. But you know that there are masses in the world, and so that wasn't destroyed by scalar invariants. Supersymmetry is something which is a space-time symmetry because it involves coordinates moving as well, and it's not happening with scalar. Might also be that since we haven't seen a Higgs, that this particle doesn't exist, so we're not allowed to write this down in high entropies, and that might be the way that's dealt with. Another way you can go. And then at dimension 5 level, probably maybe start the next time. But so you can kind of see that what I'd like to do is zoom in on how badly we do. So that this is also, the fact that this is measured and it's something like 10 to the minus 2 electron volts to the fourth power, this is something like 10 to the 18th GeV, which is squared. This is like 100 GeV squared. Shows you that we're getting these terms, but they come in with a whole range of scales. And the generic thing, this part of Lagrangian, it just rocks because it does exactly what you want. Everything you want is there. Nothing you don't want is there, is not there. I don't know if I can be honest on that, but this is a good thing. And it's not very sensitive to the scale where it is. And so almost everything you love in the standard model is here. But this one term is kind of bizarre. This one term is also kind of bizarre. You don't see the bizarrety until you start talking about gravity and bringing it up on the constant. And there is one term in here, the QCD vacuum angle, you can do the alpha, you can do the dual, where this coefficient is known to be 10 to minus 10. That may or may not be a problem, depending on how you think about it. So what I'd like to do in discussing these things is to ask, so what exactly is the naturalness issue when you have scales like this that are different from another? So it's often said that the problem is that you have, if you do loops, you have quadratic divergences that make these things diverge. And if they diverge badly, then that's a sign that high energy physics is contributing in a funny way. And I want to, when you leave the room next time, I want you to be prepared to put a silver spike through any of the part that says that. Because the one thing that you know from this class is that the cutoff is not in the answer. Physical things, when you relate physical things to physical things, cutoffs that you put in as you integrate out the high energy physics, which go away when you integrate the rest of the lower energy physics to give you the whole answer, which didn't have that cutoff, because the cutoff is just organizing your ignorance of high energy physics. It's not in the answer. What you really want to care about is how things depend on large ratios of masses, physical masses. So how do you phrase that? What's that mean? What's the proper way of phrasing the naturalness issues with these coefficients? And then I'll come to this dimension. There's one dimension in 5 term, which is 2 leptons, 2 Higgses. The coefficient which is 1 versus mass. And there's a whole bunch of dimension 6. And if I say anything at all, the thing probably there is variant for probably constant, because only have 6 variant. And they all by accident satisfy some selection. So if you see that B minus L is conserved, for instance, you won't necessarily learn. Picture that variant number and left number are by accident conserved by everything right down the standard model. Might still be true because by accident, the B minus L, all these things you can write down to dimension 6 happily by accident conserved by minus L. So there are selection rules that as soon as you see something happen that violates B or L, you test. So this is a huge success. This is a success in the sense that that's exactly the neutrino mass and nothing else. This is, you know, kind of okay in the sense we see that they're there, but we don't understand why they're there. This is a success in the sense that that's explaining why gravity's weak. And then this, no one knows yet. That's what we're going to see. So see you next week.